And we're back into summary judgment, which is what we're going to finish up this week with. And so today what I'd like to do is cover 56C, which is the new process rules under summary judgment. These are the ones that where the rules radically changed. We're going to leave those extra hypos that we didn't cover in last class and hypo 9.1 as summary on Friday, because all we're going to hopefully have left after today is just a little bit of the, you know, how you reduce things into things that can potentially be admissible for trial and some last-minute little procedural techniques. We'll just use Friday to do hypos to see the rest of the summary judgment. Because today I'd like to focus on that process and the case of cell attacks. All right, so let's go ahead and get started working on that. The first thing we gave you was a hypothetical based on our lawsuit to try and understand this. I think the hardest part about 56C that you should know is it used to be a three-part clear step that was based on who you were, whether you're the movement, and they gave you a burden of production initially. Then there was the responsive burden, and then there was the following burden after that for the court really to look at in the process. And when the rules committee got together to decide in general in redrafting in 2009 all of the civil rules of procedure for more colloquial ways to phrase things, less formalistic language, they had a big debate about whether to keep that point and counterpoint. And what happened was they rejected it, saying they thought in practice the courts were not actually uniformly doing a strict point and counterpoint. That summary judgment practice became a little bit more mushy, where it was just less of a you have an initial burden, but that when someone would respond in their brief in opposition to your summary judgment, they would raise things you did in defect. And so they felt like, well, let's do it more true to form, which is throwing it in one paragraph. Now, I don't know if they needed to do it quite this awkward, because if you read it, all the words back and forth are put for the two different people. And so when I thought about how do I teach this to people who have actually never practiced summary judgment, it's tricky. So if you like rules, you know, this is like against all the actual good standards of rule writing. Rule writing should be for anyone who's never been there. They should be able to come to the process like someone practicing in Germany can come to the United States, practice in the federal courts, read our federal rules, assuming they understand how to read English, and be able to practice because they should be put on notice of what they're expected to do. But the way they actually wrote it was, well, everyone in practice knows how this works, which is not the most effective way to write a rule. All right, so realize this one probably caused less disruption in practice than some of the rules changes did that you would feel, but this is going to feel a little bit more awkward for people who haven't actually done summary judgment practice. So what I tried to do was use the reckless dispute and have you circle the rules or the words that are relevant in the rule. But when you go back, if this is confusing to you, what you should keep in your notes is that the language with a lot of ors thrown between them is really asking you to kind of choose from amongst these words when you're a certain person, okay? And we don't mean defendant plaintiff. We mean the person moving for summary judgment or the person opposing summary judgment. So that's why I kind of bracketed them out and said select from here. I mean, it just defies even grammar. So it's a really poorly written rule. And also little procedure professors, we have our own little listserv. They all hate it too, but you know, hey, what are we going to do? This is the rule. So here we go. Reckless moves for summary judgment on plaintiff Parsons' negligence claim. And reckless asks or argues that Parsons cannot prove breach because reckless was driving with all reasonable care. And realize, remember, summary judgment is not the initial part of the lawsuit. We've actually gone through some discovery. And reckless is arguing that you're not going to be able to prove breach because he finds that there's 10 witnesses who in their affidavits or at their depositions, he believes will testify that he was driving in all reasonable with all reasonable care. In other words, he wasn't speeding, he wasn't swerving, he was looking attentively, he wasn't distracted. You know, that there's really nobody to deduce that he was acting in breach. And this is pretty much traditionally how you'll see a summary judgment motion come up. Well, either party can move for it. We saw in our last class it's much harder for a plaintiff to actually prevail on summary judgment, and so it likely would be reckless doing this against you. All right, so if we look at the rules, let's figure out our first, you know, fill in the blanks I had you look at. Let's see. Mr. Myers? Okay, who's the movement here? If we're going to use the language that the rule gives us, who qualifies for the movement in our class hypothetical? Reckless or Parsons?
Reckless?
Yes. Reckless is the movement because it's the person moving for summary judgment. So for purposes of summary judgment, you want to actually give them these labels because it'll help you work your way through the rule. And it's actually what the court will call them as well. All right. So by way of review, remember, since we also have to think of the standard, this is just the process. He's going to have to meet that standard under summary judgment, which is what we talked about on Tuesday, that what there are or not any genuine disputes of material fact. What's the first part? That's right. He's showing that there's no genuine issues of or disputes of material fact because he's trying to say we don't really need that jury on the things that need to be resolved and or...
And
the movement, reckless, is or is not entitled to judgment as a matter of law. He's not entitled to judgment as a matter of law, is what he wants to show. He's moving. Yeah, that's right. This one's is. That's okay. Now, see, first of all, we already know, like, it gets tricky. So, is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. So, just by way of review, you're showing, he's going to have to show through this process that there's no need for the jury on any of the material things, meaning there's no genuine disputes, no reasonable people could differ on the material stuff, the stuff we need to resolve. For here, the breach element. Okay? And that he's entitled to judgment as a matter of law. How is he going to show that negligence? Well, what he's trying to argue is, if she can't prove breach, because everybody's telling the court, I'm acting like a reasonable driver, she can't win, which means I'm entitled to judgment as a matter of law. If the plaintiff can't prevail on all elements of her claim, who wins? Defendant. And so that's why these are easier for the defendant to prevail on. All he needs to do is pull one of her elements loose. One thing. If he wins one of our elements, we're out of luck, okay? So he's going to try and do that on the breach element here. All right. So if we're looking at the process under 56C1, is it a process for his proving the standard with respect to the genuine disputes of material fact, or is it a process that helps us work through judgment as a matter of law?
Material fact.
Yeah, the process is about the fact dispute, because where do we find whether or not you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law? We wouldn't look to the process for that. We aren't going to look to factual disputes. How do you know when you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law?
If there's no law being broken.
Okay. So if it's like negligence, we're going to look to our common law and tort. And so the second basis of the standard is always defined by the substantive law. And truthfully, what's material is defined by substantive law. But what we're trying to do in this process is figure out how we put facts in dispute or take them out of dispute. That's what this is really about. All right? Arguing whether or not you're entitled to law, you don't really need a process. You put that in your brief and say, this is why I'm entitled to law. Look at the code, look at the common law. You need a process for how are we going to bring up the facts, how much facts are needed to make a dispute, that kind of stuff. All right, so it's all about the first piece. That's all about the process. It's all about that first piece. All right, so let's kind of work through that first piece then. Here's our first bad language choice option the rulemakers give us. A party asserting that a fact cannot be or is, and truthfully, this one I didn't add in. This is really the rule language. Like, I'm not trying to make it the multiple choice guess. That's how the rule is written. Generally disputed, must support the assertion by, and then citing particular parts of material. So if it's reckless, which words are we looking at? See, a party asserting that fact cannot be generally disputed, or is it a party asserting a fact that is generally disputed?
Cannot be.
That's right. And so for the movement, you want to read this rule with ignoring the words or is. Okay? That's why it's weird. Okay? So it's only cannot be if you're the movement. All right. And the first part, Part A, says a party asserting that fact cannot be generally disputed must support that assertion by citing to particular parts of the materials in the record, including, and it gives us a list of things we could do, or, and then we'll get to B in a second. So let's focus on A. All right, what document would the movement reckless do this in? How is he going to support his assertion? Where does this go? Okay, well, then that's right, and there's some little piece of that I gave you in addition to it. I said it's something, and then I gave you the blanks for motion for summary judgment. You're right, it's the motion for summary judgment. A motion for summary judgment, just like any other motion, if you would ever look up in a form document what a motion actually looks like, it literally is like a two-sentence move for summary judgment, okay? But you get to file something along with it. Do you know what that is? That's right. And so in legal writing, that's the thing that you're working on. If you're working on a class that does summary judgment motions, it's really the briefing paper that goes along with it. So the motion and the rules refer to that practice, that whole briefing practice. Okay? All right. The motion isn't so much the hard part. It's the briefing along with it. And this is what it gets called. You actually put on your brief the title Brief in Support of Your Motion for Summary Judgment and attach your summary judgment motion along with it. We're going to have another brief by the opposing side, and it can be called a couple different things. What's probably the most likely thing we're going to call our brief against Reckless's brief? Parsons' brief in opposition to it. What else could we do? Louis is in the last class. I don't remember it. We could do another motion. We could ourselves do it. So do you know what that's called? Right, a cross motion for summary judgment and brief in support of a cross motion in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. So you get like a 12-sentence long title to your brief. But you need to kind of keep them straight. Typically what most people do is they will move, like that can happen a lot of ways where we don't dispute the facts at all, but we are disputing how they render a judgment. That they're not in dispute, but I win. Or he says, no, they're not in dispute, but I win. Or we say, well, that's not in dispute, but this is. This is not in dispute, but that is. And so there's a whole bunch of different permutations. So that's kind of what it looks like. We're going to keep with the simplest one and just assume it's only Reckless moving at all on our dispute for summary judgment. So all we're going to file is a brief. That's it, a brief in opposition to summary judgment. A lot of times the court will also give him, and it used to be spelled out under the rules, but we're presuming you still can, a chance to write a reply brief as well after you get the brief in opposition to your summary judgment motion. It used to be spelled out in the rules. All right, the advisory committee said that there's really no substantive change. They just felt it conformed with practice, but it's not listed in there. I'm just assuming you can still do it if what they say is true. But you should know there are some judges that are more like the Scalian version of the way of reading rules, and if it's not in there, you're not going to. So you have to look for your court to see how motion practice is going to work after this new change. All right, so that's the document you're going to see it in. Or given the facts and the hypo, what kind of materials do you think Reckless should make sure are in the record before the court? And so I've got a clicker question for you here. All right. Here's some options. Okay. Affidavits made only for the purpose of the motion, answers to requests for admissions, answers to interrogatories, ESI or electronically stored information, and then your options and documents. Your options are A, all of the above, B, none of the above, C, 1 and 2 only. What do you think? Go ahead and work with your partner and click in on this one. What do you think? Given what the rule language tells us, materials Reckless should make sure are in the record before the court. Okay. Anybody else? We'll go ahead and thank you. All right. Let's see what we have. All right, good. All of the above. We got very few people answering the last ones. And just because I know sometimes we get this one and then it gets trickier later because we forget what was in it, I just want to make sure that you see the pieces I try to put in there I think are the trickier parts. The first one I think is the trickiest one, which is affidavits made only for the purpose of the motion. Oftentimes that's what you're making an affidavit for, is that you want to move for summary judgment. And what you're trying to do under an affidavit is translate what the person will testify to. And an affidavit is something that's sworn, so it is going to eventually be considered admissible. That's going to be the last kind of topic we're going to talk about tomorrow in class, is what type of level do you need to get your things you've learned in discovery to that is sufficient to support a motion for summary judgment. Because part of Celotex actually dealt with that. They had people who would say things that they recounted in letters that they attached to the summary judgment motion, but who would not swear in an affidavit. And so the court threw those out in the end. All right, but we're going to talk about that. But all the rest of them are clearly listed in the rule. All right, our next question, though, kind of in relation to this, before we move on to other options we might have. So we just want to wrap this one up. Could Reckless just say in the deposition of Fred, or does he need to pinpoint cite something in the deposition? Like, for example, can you write your brief and be like, yeah, in Fred's deposition, he says, I was the best driver ever. And you just don't pinpoint cite, you say, see deposition of Fred. Can you do that?
I would no.
Okay. Look to the rule. Because you just said it in that, like, guessing way. And I'll tell you, it's in the rule. So let's look to the rule and figure it out. Just an A. What does it say? In 56C1A.
Okay. Citing two particular parts.
And if you think you've gotten something that answered your question already?
Yeah, have
to cite. Citing to particular parts. So the deposition would not be particular because it includes all those things in it. And what this looks like in practice, because you realize, you know, you've got lots of hours you can be deposing an individual. If you actually think about what happens, you know, just the question, answer, and oral format and the transcript. A transcript of a deposition, if you use all the time and if there's like an agreement earlier stipulated to allow for more time for key witnesses, it would be like this long. The last thing, even if the rule didn't require to do it, you would ever want to do to the court is be like, see this deposition. You weed your way through it, okay? Because chances are it's going to be missed. Because a lot of times, until you get good at actually taking depositions, you'll think, oh, they said this. And then when you read it in the transcript, you realize you didn't quite say that. Which is why, like, you always are in discovery doing two things, trying to learn more about your case, but also setting up what you're going to be able to use in summary judgment, and you'll get better as you practice those. But you can always tell someone who's good at asking depositions because they get the questions, and they continue to follow until they get that right answer because they know they're going to cite to that in their summary judgment brief. And so what you do is you just excise those portions of the transcript, and you generally highlight them and file them as an appendix directly to your brief. Sometimes local practice has you tag them. There's, like, different ways to do it, but it comes right with your brief. And the other side often will be like, yeah, but on page 56, they said something else. And so you just make sure as you're going through, you check for all that. Okay, good. All right, so that's pretty much what reckless would do to start out and move for summary judgment. But we're not done because it's a long process. We now have our chance at bat. So Parsons, now you get this motion for summary judgment. You believe that it was reckless who swerves into your client and thus breached his duty to drive with all reasonable care. She can't recall anything due to her injuries, so we couldn't just put in our affidavit. And in our hypo on Friday, we'll see, is it okay if all we put in is our affidavit? Let's not get that tricky yet. Let's just say we've got someone else. We've got a really great witness, a police officer, who in his affidavit decides this is supporting your story. So what options does Parsons have under our rule? So let's look at our aspects of our rule now. Let's see, someone want to volunteer before I start looking at people I haven't called on in a while. I see lots of people hiding at the moment. Let's see. Mr. Bondra? You're not hiding, so I was like, great. Okay, so let's look at the rule, and first of all I want you to do is figure out what part of the language we're going to use to as Parsons now under our poorly written rule. A party asserting the fact cannot be or is, and remember the rule is literally written like that, so just tell me which language you're actually going to look at now in that bracket. Yeah. So just ignore the rest of it. So for ors, they kind of mean circle one. That's how they mean it. Is genuinely disputed, must support the assertion by, and do this basically the same thing. So if we look at those questions now in context of Parsons, what document would you now, representing the non-movement Parsons, do this in? Your document was the what? Yeah. Exactly. And what would you want to make sure was in the record before the court? Okay, good. So you have all the things you want to cite to. And since I gave you some facts, what do you think you'd be citing to now under a hypothetical?
Police officer,
yeah, so you just basically append to it the affidavit of the police officer. And that's exactly what it would look like. And now you'd say in your argument section of your brief that there is a genuine dispute over material fact. What's the material fact? What's material that needs to be resolved? Right, but whether he swerved or whether he drove with reasonable care. And why would you say it's now in genuine dispute?
Because you have a witness, police officer, who's supporting
Parsons' story rather than the righteous and
allowed
against him. So does that mean we're automatically
entitled to
summary judgment now, I think?
No, it just means it's in dispute, so
good. That's perfect answer. That's perfect from the top to the bottom. So in the end, it's that a reasonable person, a reasonable jury could decide either way. It helps us because we have a really great witness on our side, but should you really need that? No, because credibility issues are something the jury Fine. The other thing that we do whenever we're resolving a motion for summary judgment and there's a dispute kind of about how we should look at the evidence, how does a court look at the evidence? In what light? Right. In favor of the non-moving parties. Who is that here? Yeah. So it's not plaintiff defendant. I think sometimes people get that mixed with burden at trial because there is aspects where burden at trial comes into our process. But when looking at evidence and saying, would a reasonable jury disagree with this, realize we're kind of considering everything in favor of the non-moving party because it's sort of your burden at summary judgment to at least come up with that. And credibility issues are things that are always considered the domain of the jury. Now realize these are the standard block answers, but in practice, when you deal with different kinds of judges on close calls, a lot of times their judicial philosophy will start to seep through. So you don't want to be in the close call. You want to make yourself give as much supporting documentation because there are judges who are a little bit more predisposed to giving summary judgment, especially in certain types of cases, than others. Yeah?
Is it ever in your best interest to just hold the summary judgment, or should you all, in the best interest of your client, try and produce evidence that conflicts with whatever they're saying so that you can't go to trial?
Well, if you feel like you're not going to be able to oppose a motion for summary judgment, I think you would know even before the motion started to happen when you're looking at the evidence that you've gleaned in discovery. And what your best situation at that moment would be, like if you really feel like you're not going to win, would likely be to ask your client to reconsider the settlement offers that you've been negotiating. Because pretty much throughout all of litigation, you don't really turn off your negotiator, you know, antenna. You're always doing that as well. Because it's very, very rare you actually get to trial on anything. But if you're at the summary judgment phase, it means you're probably likely not going to settle. Either their offers haven't been reasonable or your client is unwilling to take them, in which case you fight as hard as you can fight. So it's an awkward kind of, it's a fun role, but an awkward role to play as a litigator in that you're, you know, trying to drive your client to make concessions to get out with the best deal possible. You try and work in a cooperative manner in negotiation because that works so much better than being competitive. In court, you're just the opposite. You're incredibly competitive and really trying to prevail on your points at all times. So it's kind of wearing both hats. But if you really know you're going to lose, it's, you know, you're really trying to get your client or the other side to agree to a better offer. And hopefully you can get them to, your client to go along with it before then, because if you really are going to lose, it's unlikely they're going to offer you much in settlement because they'll go away with nothing. All right. Okay. So now let's consider a different option that Parsons has, because as a non-movement, you actually have quite a few things you can do. We talked about one, which is putting forth our own statement to oppose the motion for summary judgment. Let's assume that Parsons just reads Reckless's summary judgment motion and the affidavits and the depositions of those 10 witnesses who Reckless cited to in his motion. Parsons realizes that the affidavits and depositions are not as clear as Reckless claims, and that's generally the case. For instance, one witness did testify that Reckless was driving very carefully, but 5 pages later in his transcript, the witness says, I think Reckless might have swerved into her at the end. Again, good use of deposition, questioning to try and get out something that you can use at trial. And then several other witnesses that are quoted by Reckless have similar ambiguous statements about Reckless swerving and moving over. And really at this time you're parsing out finally what they're saying and whether or not it's enough that we can say a reasonable jury can conclude any other way. So can Parsons defeat the summary judgment motion by pointing to the court that the very materials Reckless cites to create a genuine issue of material fact, that some witnesses say he did not swerve but others did? Can she do that? What do you think? A, yes, B, no. Go ahead and talk to someone. A, yes, B, no. All right, if you haven't already, go ahead and click in. Go ahead and click in if you haven't already. Thank you. Let's see what we have. Okay, good. We can. So what part of the rule permits you to do this? Since there's 98% of you who know this answer, I should get a volunteer fairly easily, I'm hoping. But I know I'll look out there and I'll be like, not me. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Crum. Okay, very good. Let's look at 56C1B. And what part of it? Is that what you said? That's good. Okay, I knew what you were talking about. Sorry. Go ahead. What part of it? Because, again, remember we've got some weird alternative language in this section. Which part are we looking at then?
They can assert that the fact that they disputed by showing that cited materials don't establish the absence of a genuine dispute.
Okay. Do not establish the absence. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay, that's right. I want to make sure I wasn't overhearing this time. That's right. That's exactly right. For her, she's wanting to say, you didn't meet really your burden as the move-in. Okay? This used to be listed under the rule as, you know, the non-move-in burden can show that the move-in failed to meet its burden. That's kind of gone. So what you're just saying is going back to the standard. Were you able to show that there isn't an absence of genuine dispute? Because remember, that's what Reckless has to win in order to get summary judgment, that there's no genuine dispute of material facts. So you're saying, no, he didn't show an absence. Again, double negative, but that's what it is. Okay. So if you were to look at what she has at this point for this option, it's the showing of material cited. Do not establish that. So first of all, we're going to talk a little bit more about showing when you get to Celotex. So let's just preview it right now. What does showing that there's the material cited do not establish the absence of a genuine dispute? What does that mean? What does showing that mean? What does that translate into? What does that translate into? Does it just mean saying, hey, look at it, I looked at it? Yeah. Thank you. That's right, I appreciate it. You kind of already did. Yeah. Yeah.
It's
that okay, in some way they have to back it up. And the hard part is here, do you have to actually disprove it? Like say, oh, look, there isn't anything there. I'm actually having my affirmative disapproval. For this part, I don't think you do. It's going to get harder when we get to whether or not she's moving for summary judgment or there's the question of whether or not we have the burden at trial. But you're right, it's something more than just saying in our brief, look at it, there's not enough there. So what I would argue is, for this point in the rule, it would be taking those pieces of the depositions that we've seen it, and it's showing, citing to the language, saying at page 1 they say this, at page 7 they say that, page 8 they say this, at page 10 they say that, and explaining why that equates to the confusion about the what actually happened. Okay? So the showing here really means like referencing those documents. You're right, you need to reference them. We'll come back to the showing again in a minute with Celotex. Yeah.
Is the same level of proof, did you say showing that the material cited do establish the presence of a genuine dispute?
No, because that's going to be a little bit trickier. But yeah, it's close. It depends, then we're going to have to get to whether or not they carry the burden at trial as well. Okay? All right. So let's just kind of summarize what Parsons has to do. Then we're going to get back to Reckless and into that little trickier piece under Celotex. All right, so she's got two options. The first was she came with a police officer. So she can say there is a genuine dispute of material fact by creating one by adding to the record. Creating one by adding something to the record. Her other affidavit, another deposition, something, ESI document that says, here's the email, which she said, man, I was swerving crazy that day. You know, whatever it is, it's additional evidence. That's under A. And B, and that's why I also have listed A and B, this is under B, is showing that Reckless's own materials don't establish that there's no genuine issue by specifically citing to them and explaining why they don't. Okay? And that makes sense, because it allows you to say, yep, there is a genuine dispute because I have created one, or he's never gotten rid of the question of whether there's a dispute. Okay, he hasn't sufficiently told us or showed us that there wasn't a dispute. Or I'm creating one by showing you some more stuff. That's what the options are. Okay, and that's actually where it fits under the rule. So make sure that when you're thinking of summarizing those in your own kind of words, this isn't the write it on the exam words, but more of the what does it mean. So A is creating it, and B is it's showing basically it doesn't exist because you're looking at their own stuff. Any questions on what you as persons have to do? Yeah.
Just back up. two more where you said create a genuine issue of material fact. It's the yes or no answer.
I'm sorry, I don't remember which question you're talking about.
Just 98% of people clicked yes.
Okay.
I guess I would click no.
Okay.
Because right down there in B, I mean, you just answered the first question. You said that it doesn't actually create a material or genuine disputed fact, but it's just the absence of a genuine disputed fact. So your yes or no, it seems like it should be more no. Yeah.
Can they defeat it? And so the answer is...
So they can defeat it, yeah, but is it showing they create a genuine disputed
Dance
the question is, they create a genuine issue of material fact, or can they defeat the motion? So kind of two.
Okay, so if you read it this way, Parsons defeats the summary judgment motion by pointing to the court that the very materials reckless cites to create him trying to create a genuine issue of material fact don't do it. So we're not saying in this question, did she create it? But rather, she's saying he didn't.
Okay.
Yeah, right. That's what it is. It's just saying the absence of him getting rid of a genuine issue material fact. But I'm really just trying to get to whether or not she can just use this as a general defeat. Okay. All right. So that's our summary of Parsons. Is there anything else on her options? Let's then look at what Reckless does now, and what we're going to see is, like, there's going to be also an alternative option for Reckless under a separate hypo, which is what I gave hypo 2. But this is just the basic, we're still in the plain vanilla. He moves, we respond, he gets to do something now. Okay, so let's assume that in our course of discussions, we've decided to go ahead and admit the affidavit of the police officer, because we want to create more dispute, that's what we're going to do. And Reckless wants to argue to the court that the court should still grant him summary judgment despite the facts brought up in her brief in opposition, okay? Which is basically, if you want to think about it, sort of like a reply, but it's called responsive briefs because replies is a pleading. You only use the word reply when you actually mean the pleading. The, you know, remember complaint, answer, reply. So in your briefing papers, these are response to Parsons' brief in opposition to, that's what motions are called, okay? Or briefs in filed with a motion is called that. And here, let's look at our first one. Let's say, is our first option, that Reckless wants to claim that there's no genuine dispute of fact because the record contains depositions of 1,000 other witnesses, all of whom support his version of the accident. Should he use A or should he use B? Let's look at this one. If Reckless wants to claim... Go ahead and click in on A here or B here. Reckless wants to claim that there's no genuine dispute of fact because the record contains the depositions of lots of other witnesses, all of whom support his version. Okay. Tell me what you think with this one, and then let's go ahead. Is everyone in? Okay, let's see. Okay. Most people have this one as A. This one's actually, I think, better placed under B. The reality is, what you're trying to show is that the materials cited establish the, you know, or in here would be do not establish the absence of a genuine issue of material fact. You're trying to show basically that what she cited, the police report, doesn't establish now the presence of a genuine issue of material fact. Because we're now on his side of the language. She was showing that the materials cited don't show the absence of the material fact, which you're just looking at the stuff and saying, look, it's not there. If we wanted to do it, we would say now, or Reckless wants to do it, we would now say that they do not establish the presence of a material fact, because even one police officer against 1,000 others isn't really a reasonable dispute of fact. Does that make sense? All right. So I think part of it is just, again, we're going back and forth between that language, that each paragraph is really meant for both at the same time. All right, well, what you should see is that A is really about introducing a lot of the evidence. B is about in reflection of what someone else has done. So whenever you're, like, in that responsive piece, that's typically where you're going to be in. In the end, does it make much of a difference? No, but know that both of those are there. A is more about citation, the original presentation. B is more about response to what they've given you. So I can understand if you pick Dave, you're thinking, like, they're additional people he's put forth, but we're kind of presuming within this one that they're there and he's showing it's not, that what she's done now doesn't show the presence of a genuine dispute. Okay.
So I'm less concerned whether you click A or B and more concerned, do you understand that you can do that under B? Yes. Okay. Under B, remember it was the presence or absence, and she could have said there is a genuine dispute of material factors, which she's trying to do. He's now using B to show that the materials she cites do not establish the presence of a material fact. The police report alone is not enough
to create a genuine dispute of material fact because a reasonable jury couldn't look at 1,000 people against one police officer and conclude that the police officer was corrupt.
So why do you say that instead of saying, you know, I'm citing to the particular piece that the affidavit of the police officer?
Because that one's more of like actually starting out with the presentation of evidence. And so here I'm presuming this is in the record and what he's doing is saying now in his argumentation, but hers doesn't actually establish a dispute. Okay? Yeah.
Last one.
You can't.
So this was gross
and survive summary judgment? Unlikely, because it's really not so much when we said you can stand on your own, it's true that that's not going to be insufficient just because it's yours. But at some point, we're going to say it's not reasonable, it's no longer a genuine dispute because there's so much evidence the other side. Otherwise, you would always be able to defeat summary judgment by, like, I found the one person who happened to see it the way I want to see it. Okay? For some judges, I'll tell you, because I worked with a very liberal judge, he was almost along the lines of it had to be almost at 1,000 to 1 before he would, if there was anybody disputing it, take it from a jury. Because his view of the jury was more sacrosanct, like, look, they're there to resolve the factual disputes, it's not me. But in practice, I've seen other judges that are very much, nope, these people are incredible, we could possibly believe them, even though that's not supposed to be their role. Okay. So that's why I bump up the numbers, so that even I think for the people who are really, really in favor of keeping the jury's role and not taking it away, at some point they're going to have to say, a reasonable jury really just couldn't look at the face of this evidence and say that there's actually a genuine dispute. Yeah.
If Parsons would have gone with the second option, showing that the movement's materials don't establish there's no genuine dispute, would it, the answer of them been A, that he could have cited to additional witnesses and additional depositions to show that there isn't a genuine dispute?
I don't know if it would change the answer to A, but he still could do that. And I guess I'm telling you in the end, I'm less concerned if you think that fits A or think that fits B, but more concerned if you understand the language permits you to do that. That it either permits you to put forth evidence, either to create a genuine issue or to dispel one. And that it also permits you to look at what people put forward and say that that doesn't make it. That doesn't make a genuine issue or it doesn't get rid of a genuine issue. That's what I like, really what I'm more concerned about. So less than the truly is it A or B. But I don't think that one would even be A either, because I'm presuming here that these are already in the record. A is sort of like creating new by putting new things in. So if you read the question as these are new, then I can see where you put A. But yet it doesn't really, I'm really more concerned of you can put stuff in, or you can look at what's there and say that's a genuine dispute or not. Okay? All right. Sometimes the clickers sting me every once in a while. I'm like, I really don't care. I just want you to know that point. All right, so here we go. Here's the next one. If Reckless wants to claim that there's no genuine dispute of fact because Parsons' witness should be ignored, the police officer admits that she did not see the actual impact but arrives at the scene after the accident. We have the same kind of aspect here. I think this one, again, is a good one to say under B because you're trying to say that what she's cited to doesn't actually show the presence of a genuine dispute. But again, it doesn't matter. You can either introduce the evidence in or you can point to what they have and say why it doesn't work, and it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. What is the admissibility?
We're going to get to admissibility on Friday because it's a whole other issue. Okay. But you do have to have evidence that at some point can be rendered admissible. And so all you have to do is, if it's under affidavit, there's less of an issue. You would just say that it's not believable, but that's not so much admissibility. Admissibility is truly about, like, under the rules of evidence can it come in.
Okay.
Not should we believe it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is this B because he's looking at the evidence that's already there and making...
I think that's the best one to put it under. But again, yeah. Again, it's more making sure that you can see. You can do either. You can put in evidence to dispel or create a genuine issue of material fact. You can also see what's in there and say there is or is not a genuine issue of material fact. But that's what the or languages for both of these are entitling you to do. Okay? All right, good. All right, so to summarize so far what options Reckless has, he can convince a court that there's no genuine dispute of material facts by citing to more evidence in the record. Or putting more evidence in the record, okay? However you want to read it. If it's putting more, it's clearly A. If it's citing, it could be A or B. B, showing that Parsons' materials don't establish there's a genuine dispute. That one's clearly B. But either way, putting more evidence in, citing the evidence, pointing to her is showing why it's insufficient. So his kind of response to her response is very similar. Her. Yes. No. You can actually do both. You don't have to do both. That's why there's the or between A and B. But you have the options to do both. So you could say, like, if Reckless wants to now put in those, let's say those original witnesses were not part of the record, he wants to put in 1,000 witnesses and show why the police affidavit is inconsistent, you can do both. And that would be a much better motion. But a lot of times you really can't. Normally, if you have evidence, you put it in. That's all I'll tell you in practice. If you have evidence that either can create or get rid of a genuine issue of material fact, there's really no reason not to put it in. It's just that oftentimes there isn't. And what you want is to get to the jury to say, should you believe these people? They've kind of said some inconsistent things. Maybe they didn't really perceive what they said they perceived. That's typically what you're doing. Okay? All right, let's look at one more option he has, and this is really unique to Reckless. So the others have been kind of similar. This is unique to Reckless. Let's assume that Reckless, the defendant, decides to move for summary judgment, citing to evidence that disproves plaintiff's claim that he was negligent in the first hypo, but now, instead, he simply wants to argue that Parsons cannot meet her burden of proving that he breached a duty of reasonable care, because after all, it is Parsons who's going to bear the burden of proving his breach at trial. So understand what we're doing now. This is something uniquely to a defendant. Like starting from the very beginning, when we started our summary judgment motion, he initially had witnesses that said, I was totally being careful. Now instead what he wants to do is say, I've looked at all the evidence and she doesn't have anybody who says I was negligent and it's her burden of proof. So he's just trying to say she has the absence of things she's going to need to win at trial and therefore I should be entitled to judgment. Understand what this kind of argument is? Is there any questions on what we are talking about before we get into it? Okay. So you're saying basically you can't carry the day at court. I might not have great witnesses, but you can't carry your burden. So in his motion, he says, I'm entitled to judgment because plaintiff cannot prove breach, an essential element of her case. And the big question is, does the rule permit him to do this? And there is a part in 56C that permits him to do this. There's one small line, which is the hope that the Rules Advisory Committee didn't actually get rid of Celotex unintentionally. Does anyone see it in there? One small line that would permit him to possibly do this. 56C, 1, it's in B. Yes?
Where it says, or that average probably cannot use physical evidence to support the fact.
Yeah. Yep. So it's this part. If you were to tie in the part that's showing that the adverse party cannot produce admissible evidence to support the fact. And remember, we're going to talk about what is admissible, what isn't, that evidentiary issue. But you're just saying, you can't do it. You can't. You haven't been able to do it. I'm kind of challenging you. If you got it, bring it now, or let's rule. Don't go to the trial. That's pretty much what you're saying. It's kind of saying, like, ante up. That's what this is. All right, and it's really more uniquely for the defendant because you're seeing it's the plaintiff who has to bear the burden at trial. We're saying you're never going to be able to do it. Let's just give me judgment now. All right, so how would Parsons do this? How could he make a showing? I mean, think about it. How do you show she can't win? She doesn't have what she needs to win on negligence, to win on breach. What could you do? Yeah.
She didn't have the police
Okay, so there's no affidavits. And so how would you show that? Oh, well, yeah, you put it in your brief, but the hard part is, like, figuring out what would it look like to show that. So maybe it's just an argument that says, you know, she can't do it. Maybe it's, like, here's some, just kind of theoretically, we'll talk about some options. Maybe it's, she's actually, you're pointing out things and specifically designating why they're insufficient. She says this is what she's going to use, this is why it's insufficient. Or maybe it's even saying, you actually have to put on proof of your absence from negligence, like actually disproving her case. So there's lots of things we could do, and that's actually what Celotex was about. Because the case before Celotex that had you read in the like introductory addicts actually suggested that a defendant who wanted to show that a plaintiff couldn't bear their, you know, win their day at court would actually have to produce affirmative evidence almost of that. And Celotex kind of takes us back from that. This is a case in which we've got a decedent's wife who's suing in a wrongful death suit against Celotex, which is a corporation that makes asbestos. And her husband died of asbestosis through, I think, construction or some sort of industry he was in. Now, the problem with things like this, and if you started talking about products liability, is it's unlikely that the company you're working with uses one brand of product that contains asbestos. So there's lots of manufacturers. And Celotex is really filing for summary judgment saying that she doesn't have enough proof to say it was us, that he was exposed to our product and the causation linkage between it was our product that caused your damage. Sure, asbestos can cause asbestosis, but was it our asbestos? And so the element that we're worried about is the causation element. And if they can show or prevail that she's unable to prove causation, they should win. Even if he had some exposure to other people's products. And at trial, typically, it's the plaintiff, or always, it's the plaintiff who bears this burden of proof unless there's some sort of burden-shifting paradigm in your jurisdiction or some sort of statute that would help people who are subject to toxic torts. And sometimes there are. There's sometimes plaintiff-friendly things, but there isn't here. So it's just like any other case. All right, so how are you, if you're Celotex, going to do this? Let me just kind of give you some, I just sort of preview them, but in the context of Celotex, talk about what we might ask you to do. One thing we could ask you to do is just simply say, put in your motion, guess what, she can't prove causation. And then have her come forward with some evidence of causation. The other option we could do is have you do something where you actually do discovery and then point out, saying, look at all this that we have. Nobody in this stuff says that there's causation elements and that there's nobody who can link his exposure over the relevant period of time to our product. They just say, oh, products that look like ours, but there's lots of manufacturers. We don't know if it was us. Right? The last option we could do would be to say, Celotex, you must prove that you're not the cause. In other words, come forward with your records and say, where did you distribute it? In what buildings? At what time? And so we can link it up with whether he was working on it at that time, okay? So before we get to what Celotex actually holds, and I really give you the chance to do this, but I'll go ahead and do it today, what do you think the rules should be? There's no right or wrong here. I just want you to think about it. You can work with someone with you. Just what do you think would be the best policy to put into place? Which option? A, B, or C, or 1, 2, or 3? Which one do you think would be the best? I'm letting you be the court. What one would you go with? You see Celotex here? What do you want them to do? We got good courts over here. 1, 2, or 3? What should it be? What do you think it should be? If you haven't already, go ahead and click in. Anybody else? Okay. Let's just see what our thoughts are. Okay, well, most people picked 2. We have some people on, let's see, we've got just a few. You have 4 on A and 3 on C, and everybody else likes option 2. All right, so let's talk about, since everyone liked option 2, and there's a few people might want to fight for option 1, why did you, for those of you in option 2 camp, push out option 1? What didn't you like about it? Yeah.
I thought that nothing then would get decided because the defendant's always going to say, is always going to refute whatever the claim is.
What do you mean by they're always going to refute the claim?
They're always going to say that they can't prove something. I think it's likely.
Okay, so I think what you're saying is that they're always going to want, they're going to have a great incentive to just keep saying,
yeah,
you can't prove breach. Hayes, motion for summary judgment number 2, you can't prove causation.
And hey, why don't you prove damages while you're at it? Summary judgment motion on duty. Summary judgment motion on, you know, like, if you think about it, this really does incentivize the defendant to really file for summary judgment motion and file for it early. And what does it do? It basically moves your trial up to summary judgment, which people argue is what's already happened. But that you have this kind of, you know, I'm defendant, I can almost harass you with it, right? Just filing. Because all I have to do is say, you haven't shown me anything, step up and give me stuff. And it allows me to really kind of test out your case by you coming forward very early and having to show up before we get to trial, which you may not be able to do at that point in litigation. You might need some more discovery to do that. All right, why do we reject number 3 generally, with the exception of 3 people who really like it? So you can defend it. Well, why do we reject number 3? Because we got past 1 and clicked 2 and then things like that.
because it's more than just a show, you have to actually prove that.
What's so wrong about that? I mean, Celotex is producing asbestos all over the place.
Shouldn't they have to prove that it wasn't theirs? I know you're regret raising your hand. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Why not? Why did you not like that? Did they have to prove it?
Because then,
so under this one, they're going to have to show we were not the asbestos product he had. What's so bad about that?
I think it's a little bit harder for him to prove. And then, you know,
okay,
by showing lack of evidence for causation, it's, you know, that's kind of the whole, that's all you really need to do is if you don't have any evidence that really caused a case against such person to try to prove that they, there's no causation.
Okay, so you think about it, one thing I think you're saying is the difficulty that it's going to be for the defendant. I mean, think about how difficult it is to prove a negative, that we were not the cause. I mean, that means that Celotex is going to have to come forward and almost really offer up who it was. And how likely are they going to have that kind of documentation many years later? I mean, asbestosis, I don't know if you know anything about it, it's not like you just go to your factory one day and 2 days later you have asbestosis. We're talking about, like, it's cancer. It's repetitive exposure for years and years, and generally it's people who have a predisposition to it anyway. So you have to look back in time and be like, well, was that the one that caused it? And then there's, like, disputes about whether or not it actually causes asbestosis, not so much anymore, because it kind of causes a really specific type of cancer, which is why we call it asbestosis. But it still, was it ours that caused it as opposed to somebody else's? I saw some other hands over here. Why else did you not like 3? Other hands. They were up. Yes. Uh-huh.
I feel like, at least in the Celotex case, if they were to go with number 3, it would open them up to liability for other people.
What do you mean, open up liability?
Well, if they have to affirmatively prove that they did not supply the asbestos for this particular plaintiff, they would essentially have to open up all of their sales records and show that wherever the plaintiff was working is not in the sales records.
Okay. I think in some ways, though, in discovery, they're likely to have to open up a lot of their sales records anyway. I don't know if it would be more. I just think it's going to be almost impossible to pinpoint. One other thing I think that's kind of offensive to this is who typically has to prove this. Plaintiff. And so you're saying, really, for to get judgment as a matter of law, you almost have to bear the burden your opponent would have to bear at trial to win seems pretty aggressive. And so what does Celotex actually hold? 2. That's all you have to do. So what's the difference then in practice? We can say in theory, oh, it's number 2, but how do I know when I see it that I've gotten to number 2, that I've gotten past number 1? Well, what Celotex was trying to do was really just, or the plaintiff there to try and oppose it, was just sort of like point to the state.
She had a couple things that were inadmissible, so we can't consider it, but aside from that, she really didn't have anything other than her statements in her brief. All right. What you could do is actually cite to the discovery evidence and show why it shows an absence of it. Cite to the discovery evidence and show why it shows an absence of it. All right. So in the end, that's the actual answer. And if you want to look for quotes in your language in your case where you find it, there's two separate quotes. One's on page 171, and then I'm sorry, 171, 751, and 752. Not even close. All right, 751, right underneath that little blue box. If you want to take that first sentence and star it, that's the first piece. A party seeking summary judgment always bears the initial responsibility of informing the district court of the basis for its motion and identifying those pleadings and affidavits. Right now, that's I think 56C1A. And then the second quote is on 572. If you look to, just to start it, underneath the next convenient little blue box, that very last sentence in that paragraph, the burden on the moving party may be discharged by showing, that is, pointing out to the district court that there's an absence of the record. That's basically what we mean, like taking the discovery and saying, look here, look here, look here. No one actually says this. All right, so that's what it is. So we're going to start tomorrow with thinking about if you're the plaintiff in this perspective and then going through those typos, because we're basically done with what we have for Celotex. The only thing we have left is to talk about from plaintiff's perspective. All right, good job.